In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
That is right. Alan Adams joining us in studio here to talk movies and more. Hello, Al.
Hello, sir. How are you?
Nice to see you. I'm great that you're here. Carrie's here. The band back together.
Yeah, like it's funny. I had I knew Carrie was in town, but I had forgotten that he would be here until I heard him on my way in, and I was like, oh, right, Carrie's here. And it just like, he just brightened my day just a little bit more. It's just, it's good to see you, man.
What he does.
Yeah. I get that a lot.
Yeah, that Carrie Haskell, he is one delightful ray of sunshine.
He is.
You hear that all the time.
And he's not even wearing his Evel Knievel jumpsuit. That really brightens things up.
I got to get that ready for Mardi Gras. That's...
Now, what's your Halloween outfit? Have you decided yet?
Yes, I actually have not seen the final product yet, but a lady who works in the costuming designing industry and is a mutual friend created a Fezzik outfit for me.
Oh, solid.
Yeah.
That's solid.
And I got the wig. I got a belt that I got to do some modifications to.
Sure.
I don't have boots, but I do have the wraparound sort of like the Santa boots that will have
that'll work.
That'll suffice for this year. I'll improve it. And I still need to make a paper mache rock.
Well, don't we all?
So I got a few things to tidy up, but
yeah, but you got time.
Yeah,
you got time.
It's fantastic. Preparations underway at the Adams House for Halloween. Always a big event in your hood.
Yep. The candy has started arriving. although that has been secreted, so I'm not going to be able to, because I can't be trusted.
Oh, does she hide it from you?
I ask her to.
Yeah,
she would not do that. That is not something she would do of her own volition. But I'm like, look, Sheridan, like I know who I am, I know what I'm about.
Yes,
and what I'm about is eating too much candy because it's in my house. So it's better that I don't have ready access to it.
Yeah.
And we've been discussing some costume stuff for Halloween, but also for the upcoming gala at Penobscot Theater Company.
Yeah, I'm so disappointed. I'm going to miss that.
Oh, that's right. You're going to be on the road.
I'll be on the road for a football game, but Abby's working feverishly on her costume.
Yeah. We're kicking around a couple costume ideas. We'll see how that comes together, but we'll more as it develops.
Speaking of couple costumes, just to add in, Loretta shall be Princess Buttercup.
Okay, I was gonna ask. I'm like, it's like, you don't want to make assumptions.
I tried to convince her because of the height difference to go with Mancini, but she said no.
If you're listening, like Loretta, like you could pull it off. That's all I'm saying. You could pull it off.
I can't wait to see the pictures. Man, oh man. Well, what's up with movies? Did you get to see any since last we spoke?
You know, I did. I got to see a couple, actually. I'm very, like, it's, I always look forward to these conversations, but this week in particular, I'm looking forward to this conversation because I saw two films. I went to the theater and saw the Joker sequel.
Oh, you did. Okay,
so
good.
We'll be chatting about. I've got some things. I've got some thoughts. And I also got to see the latest one from the Boss Man here, Salem's Lot on HBO Max. So I'm happy to discuss either of those, whatever order you want to go in.
Well, let's go with Salem's Lot first.
Okay. Yes. I will. I don't have quite as much to say about that one.
That's so what I thought.
That makes a lot of sense. So it's Salem's Lot. It's based on the Stephen King novel from 1975 of the same name. This version, which is the first actual theatrical version, I didn't realize that. There have been a couple of miniseries efforts.
Mm.
One in like the late 70s and one in like the mid aughts.
Right.
But this is the first time it's gotten like the full feature film treatment, written and directed by Gary Dauberman, who did such a great job bringing the It films to the screen. So that was pretty great. This movie had some issues along its way to reaching our screens. It was initially set for a theatrical release, like 2 years ago now. But due to some, a number of factors, post-COVID production delays, the writer's strike, et cetera, it just kept getting pushed and pushed. And finally, they decided that they were just going to pivot and add it to the HBO Max lineup. Not least because all those factors had led to them having a pretty significant dearth of content. So that's what made it happen. It dropped this weekend. Stars Lewis Pullman, Mackenzie Lee, a couple of familiar faces in supporting roles. William Sadler, Alfre Woodard. It's one of those things where do I need to tell people what Salem's Lot is about? Like, I was thinking about that on the way over here. I'm like, boy, I'm guessing the people who are listening to this right now don't need a whole lot of plot synopsis.
Right. I'm thinking if you're from around here and you haven't watched or read the book, then you're probably not here with us.
This is what I'm saying. But long story short, it's a period piece, so it is set in the which is great.
Nice.
This is not a film. It's very much of its time, of its moment, so it's really nice to sort of see it sort of exist, stay within that sort of time frame. It's set in a small town called Jerusalem's Lot, there's a creepy old house with a history. It's a very small town where everybody knows everybody's business, and vampires show up. Yeah, I mean, I think that's
about it.
Yeah, we don't really need to go too much into the weeds as far as plot synopsis is concerned. I was very interested to watch this because for a number of reasons. First of all, I think like Salem's Lot is an excellent book that has seen a couple of ambitious but flawed adaptations along the way, and I think that's kind of what we got again. I will be perfectly honest and no disrespect to the boss man. Because again, like he didn't really have he wrote the book 40 years ago, 50 years ago.
Yeah,
good
yeah.
Lord. We're all ancient. Let's just, but I will say that it took a minute, like for the initial beginnings of the movie, it struggled to find its footing a little bit. And, I'm not entirely sure why that is, although In researching, I did read a couple of things where they talked about there's a full-on hour or more of footage on the cutting room floor for this. Like, the initial cut was something like 3 hours, and they got it down to like an hour 45. So I'm guessing a lot of the sort of world-buildy, subplotty, like, color that King is so good at, it tends to get, like, sort of lost in these kind of adaptations, just because, you know, if you're looking to do something in a tight hour 45, like, you don't have room for a lot of digressions.
Right.
And one of the things that I love about his work in general, and this work in particular, is the sort of historical digressions. Like, he creates the history of the places that he's created as well. And so that's part of the joy of it. And you don't get as much of that. There's some hints at it. Like, we spend a little time in the library and our hero, the erstwhile prodigal son, Ben Mears, who has returned home. We see him sort of researching some things. There's the creepy old house known as the Marston House. I get the impression that we lost a lot of that backstory, which I missed. It's one of those things where sometimes you just find yourself, well, everyone, like, it's clearly a creepy house, but why is it creepy? And why are people upset by it? And we don't get a lot of clarity on that. That being said, once it really finds itself and it starts to cook a little bit, it's pretty fun. Like, it's I'm all for a vampire movie. I love the idea of 70s main folks getting turned into vampires. And there's something about a salty Mainer being like, I don't believe this. And then it's like, oh, yeah, no, you're going to believe it, pal.
Yeah.
no, you're going to get drunk here in a second, and not in the good way. it was fun. It was a fun watch. And I think at a certain point, like, that's really, like, that's the expectation you should have for something like this, particularly when you realize that you've got all this material that's been condensed down so so thoroughly. But yeah, it looks good. Like, they did a great job with capturing the sort of period vibe. The performances are solid. I will say, and this is nobody's fault, but it is not fair for you to take these gifted character actors, throw them out there, and be like, do a main accent. It's not fair.
No,
it's not fair. Like, I've lived here all my life, and I can't do one. Not a good one, you know? And it's like, and look, you know, like, folks, like, there's a scene, and it, like, I, you know, one of those scenes where you laugh when you're not supposed to laugh. And it was William Sadler and Alfred Woodard having a conversation, both of whom trying to do the accent. They are, like, again, they're game. They're doing their best, but they do not sound like they are from the same place. And the vast majority of the other people in the film just said to hell with it. And just, like, you could almost tell, like, where in the shooting order a scene happened, because it's like, you know, there are scenes where everybody's kind of doing it, and then there are scenes where, like, pretty much everybody's like, no, I'm not doing that.
No, it's not working.
Just like, everybody's got tired, and everybody is just like, let's just get through this. But I'm glad that this book got the cinematic treatment. Do I wish that circumstances had maybe been a little bit better for it? Mm. Yes. But it does mean that if you want to watch it at home, you can. And, you know, it 'tis the season. Like, it's right. we're in spooky movie season. Look, they're like, it's Halloween time. The leaves are falling. It's cold and drizzly outside. Like, there are a lot of worse ways to spend a couple of hours.
Yeah. That was the first King book I read. I think I was a senior in high school when I read it, and I couldn't sleep. I read the whole thing in one night because I was afraid to turn off the lights.
Yep, that'll do it.
Yeah, that
will do it. He's good at that.
Yep,
still good at that.
Every time I opened my windows, I expected to see Danny Glick outside. Man, oh man! All right, that's the word on Salem's Lot. Now, the Joker, the newest Joker, hammered by the critics. Not a great weekend at the box office. Tell us why, Alan.
Oh man, so I've had a couple of conversations about this movie since I saw it. And one, like, the initial ask whenever you tell someone you've seen any movie, it's like, oh yeah, I saw X. They're like, the immediate response is, oh, how was it? And usually that's a pretty easy question to answer.
Sure.
So Joker, folie à deux, is one of those movies. I don't know that like and dislike really enter into it. It's like beyond like taste, if that makes sense.
Okay.
And I think I mean that in a kind of sort of complimentary fashion. Look, the off the bat, let's just make this clear. Todd Phillips, the filmmaker, clearly was not pleased with the way people engaged with the previous film. And granted, like, if you want to rip him for, like, basically making, like, a Scorsese pastiche with that movie and then just sort of slapping some IP, like, ideas on it, have at it. I didn't hate the movie as much as some people did. I certainly didn't like it as much as a lot of people did. But one of the things that became clear was a lot of people, the usual suspects, viewed the main character as a bit of a hero. Like, something to, an aspirational figure. Like, this is, and it's like, oh, gross. You're idiots. Also gross. And so what Mr. Phillips seems to have done, at the encouragement of Joaquin Phoenix, who, and this can't be stressed enough, apparently pitched the movie to Phillips because he had a dream where he was in full Joker makeup on a stage singing.
He's all
like,
right, then.
He's like, hey, I'm just imagining here, but he's like, hey, Todd, so what do you think about this? And Todd Phillips, being like, well, you know, I could probably get, you know, $150 million from Warner Brothers, and I could just flip Double Birds to everybody.
Right.
And so that's what he did.
Wow.
That is what he did. This movie is it's clearly aimed at alienating the two sorts of, like, fan bases of the previous film, whether it's the people who want to view the character as some sort of, like, condemnation of the urban blight of the, you know, the late 20th century, you know, the decline of decline of civilization through capitalism, and the rapid descent of law and order, you know, to hell with those people, says Todd Phillips. And then there are the people who are like, oh, I just want to go and watch the Joker, like, shoot people and you know, get after it and fight guys. And, you know, and Todd Phillips says, to hell with you as well. What you're going to get is a barely coherent musical. That's what you're going to get.
Well, there.
We're going to start with an extended animated recap of the first film. That's how we're going to open our movie. And then we're just going to go from there. And what we get is we see him in prison. The Joker, Arthur Fleck, played by Joaquin Phoenix, is in not. It's, I mean, it's prison. It's ostensibly a mental hospital, but it is a prison. It's the usual Arkham in Gotham kind of situation. He's become very withdrawn. The guards taunt him pretty regularly, you know, basically always asking him, hey, you got a joke for us, stuff like that. He's awaiting trial for the crimes that he committed in the first film, including, again, the live on air execution of the talk show host played by Robert De Niro. But he's sort of moving back and forth, going to get his meds. And along the way, he encounters Lee Quinzel, that would be Lady Gaga, who is in the minimum security wing of the mental institution, and she's very fascinated by our Mr. Fleck, and so before you know it, they sort of connect and start doing the things that happen when crazy people connect. Eventually, we move on. His lawyer is played by the wonderful Catherine Keener, is doing her best to try to, you know, sort of get him. Basically, the hope is to do an insanity plea. Like, that's the goal. No one believes it. We have, and we sort of progress from there. We watch as his relationship with Lee develops. We watch as the trial sort of starts to unfold. We see the dynamics within his incarceration play out. And interspersed throughout, Rich, Carrie, are musical numbers.
Does he sing Shallow with Gaga?
That would be cool. He does not. That would have been great. I'm kind of surprised. But here's the thing. The musical numbers are essentially numbers from movie musicals. They do a duet on That's Entertainment.
Okay.
There are songs from, like, easy listening songs from the 1970s. Close to You is one that gets sung pretty well. And all of these numbers are they are separate from the main sort of movie, and they're all stylized in such a way as to sort of recapture or recreate the vibe inherent to the song that they are singing. And so you have a lot of scenes that are basically like recreations of 70s variety shows. Like, there's a full-on, like, I mean, it's, and I mean, like, I don't even, it's, I don't even, you can't even call it a parody. It's basically a recreation of, like, the opening of, like, the Sonny and Cher show, where they come out and sing together. And then there are, If we're not on the set of a 70s variety show or a 70s talk show, we're on the set, like, now I've had some difficulty articulating this, but it's, you remember in like in old movies that sort of that stylized, like, black, like, pure black backdrop with just like one illuminated set piece.
Yeah.
Like a lot of those.
Mm.
Do you know, to kind of capture that old-timey, like, movie musical vibe.
Now, do these musical moments happen in the mind of the characters, or are they part of the story?
They are very separate. Like, the idea, I think, is that, I mean, they're not happening in, like, quote-unquote reality. Like, I think that's pretty safe to say. They are basically sort of, I don't know, like evocations of the emotional state of the characters in the moment. But there is no rhyme or reason to when they appear. It's all very haphazard. You're just watching what is, you know, ostensibly like a sort of a psychological thriller or a courtroom drama. Like the back half of the movie is all set in the courtroom, but it's all interspersed with these moments of these weird, like, people just breaking into song and like these extended musical montages, and it doesn't make any sense. Like, none of it makes any sense, and I feel like that is a deliberate choice on the part of the filmmaker. I feel like Todd Phillips went in there. I don't know if his leads knew what he was doing necessarily, because again, like, say what you will about Joaquin Phoenix, dude goes for it.
Oh yes,
and he's going for it here. I feel like the vibe I've gotten is that maybe Lady Gaga feels like she got sold a bill of goods with this whole situation. I can't say for certain, but I think the backlash has been unexpected for her. I don't think she was anticipating the reaction that the film got. Look. You'll notice that I haven't talked a lot about the story, and there's not really much of that. Like, it's just a lot of pieces kind of stitched together in a way that, I mean, I suppose from 30,000 feet, like, it maybe looks coherent, but when you start getting close, it's just like, I don't understand. I don't understand why any of this is happening. I don't understand what's real and what's not, and maybe that's part of the choice. One of the, like, the whole notion of Fully Ado, which I didn't know, our friend Katie Toole actually informed me that it is basically, and I'm dumbing it down here, but like, it's basically a shared delusion between two people.
Oh.
So a delusion that is amplified by each people, like, so that, I mean, it makes perfect sense as a subtitle to this film, because that kind of, it's a little on the nose actually as far as that goes. But so as far as like the idea of what's real and what's not, like, they played with that some in the previous film. They really lean into it in this one to almost absurd degrees at times. And I can say with certainty that the people that many of the people in the screening that I attended had not done any research and were not at all prepared for what they were about to get. The murmurs of befuddled confusion as we filed out of the theater were plenty. It was this one guy in front of me was rolling out, and he's like 45 minutes in, I had to look it up, and do you know what? They said it was a musical, and it's like, yes, man, they did. Lady Gaga's in it. Like, what did you think was going to happen? Now, I say all this, and yet, visually, this was a very interesting movie. The sort of rapid kind of back and forth juxtaposition between the sort of griminess of prison and like these brightly colored, like, 1970s relics. It was like, it was interesting. It was visually interesting. And you know me, like, anytime an artist decides to just go full on like antagonistic towards the audience, like, I'm always going to respect that, particularly when you're being antagonist to this particular kind of audience, because you know, to heck with those guys. Like, you know, like, this is not like, this is not a person to be admired, and you're kind of an idiot for feeling that way. Sorry, I feel like I'm just channeling Todd Phillips at this point. So in terms of like execution, I think it was pretty good. In terms of narrative coherence, sort of audience engagement, knowing what the hell's going on. Yeah, no, thumbs down on all of that. Like, none of it, like I said, it doesn't make sense in terms of the story. We're deliberately muddled as far as like what's real and what's not, and not always in a way that feels deliberate. Like, it's one of those things where it's like, oh, like, this doesn't make sense. Does it not make sense because a conscious choice was made, or does it not make sense because nobody knows what the heck is going on? And I think it's like, it's at any given moment, like, it's basically a coin flip as to which is true. All that being said, I have to confess that I did not have a bad time. I was expecting to have a bad time. Will I ever watch this movie again? No. No, absolutely not. I'll put it this way. At about an hour in, I kind of sat up in my seat and I settled in and I'm like, you know what? I am so stoked that I'm going to get to talk to Rich about this movie on Monday. Like, that's, and you know,
just like going, you know, for the ride.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's like, I always enjoy these conversations, but it's like, but it's movies like this where I'm like, oh yeah, like we're going to have some fun talking about this one. And we did. And again, like I said, Joaquin Phoenix, is going for it. Lady Gaga is a much more talented actress than I still think she gets credit for. Catherine Keener was wonderful, although she had almost nothing to do. The head guard at Arkham was played by the always incredible Brendan Gleeson, who also had was criminally underutilized. And there are like little sprinklings of the Batman mythos throughout, and like character names and that sort of thing. But I'm going to say this. Spoiler alert. Everybody out there, if on the off chance that this is a movie that you have not seen and somehow still want to after listening to me talk about it, the final, and this is arguable, and I'm like, and I have not seen a lot of discussion about it out there yet. I imagine there's plenty of it to come. The argument has always been that these films exist separately from the other sort of Batman cinematic universes. I would argue that the last 10 seconds of this movie are indicative of the possibility that this movie is tied in with the Nolan trilogy.
Whoa.
Yes.
Whoa,
I don't know if that's true. That was just something that I sort of picked up. I'm not going to go into the specifics because, again, like, I don't want to get... I could see an argument being made. I'll put it that way. I don't know if that's a good thing. It's probably not, but here we are. So yes, I had it all geared up, sitting down. Like, I'm sitting down, the movie's getting ready to start, and I'm like, oh, I'm gonna get on there. I'm gonna call it Joker Folly a poo, and it's gonna be great. And then it's like, and I can't really, because it's a weird movie. It's a nonsensical movie. I mean, it's even probably a bad movie, but it's not nearly as terrible as I really kind of thought it was going to be. And it's terribleness, the terribleness that it has, of which it has plenty, is interesting. It's interesting, terrible, terribly interesting, as they say. honestly, it could have been worse.
There's a blurb and a half right there. I love it. Thank you so much, Alan.
My pleasure.
Alan Adams talking movies with us.